So it was 2009. I don't know what you were doing that summer. I was in Kolkata, India. I'd just been dropped off at the entrance to one of the many gigantic slum communities in the city. Now, I don't know what you envision when I say a slum community. Maybe you think something small, maybe you think something big. Kolkata is a city of 20 million people. Many of the slums were bigger than Eau Claire. So it's big, right? And as I'm walking in to this place, I have this dawning realization that I am in an exceptionally vulnerable position. Now, I'm 6'3", a well-networked, college-educated, upper-middle-class, white American guy with an intimidating beard. Vulnerable is not a feeling that I experience all that often, if I'm being honest. But here I was on the other side of the world in a place I'd never been before. I didn't even really know just where in this gigantic city this particular slum was. And if my life depended on it, I couldn't get back to the airport or anywhere else. I didn't know how to navigate the city. I didn't speak the language. I couldn't even read the alphabet because it's completely different characters. It's just a jumbled mess to me. I'm going into a place where the cops don't go because they are afraid to go in there. And it's not like I have the option of just, you know, blend in with the crowd, right? I'm a full foot taller than the average Bengali man, and you know, a little bit fairer in my complexion, just a touch. So I'm really vulnerable. However, the thing I had going for me was that I had 150 rupees in my pocket, and wherever you are in the world, money talks, right? Unfortunately, 150 rupees is like $2.25. So I had nothing going for me. I was vulnerable. I could go missing in a city of 20 million, and it would be a while before anyone would notice. So what would you do? What would you do in that kind of situation? Maybe you've been in that kind of situation, but what would you do if you ended up in a strange country where you didn't know the land, you didn't know the people, you didn't know the customs, you didn't have any connections or resources? And then what if, just to make it more complicated, you were part of a different ethnic group? But not just any ethnic group. Let's say you were part of one that was actually despised and actively discriminated against by the majority of people in this country. What do you do? What's your next step there? What's your plan? What's your next move? I ask because that's the situation that Ruth finds herself in the beginning of Ruth chapter 2. It's precisely this situation. Like Jamie said, Amy introduced us to Ruth, and in Ruth chapter 1, right, we get the beginning of the story. There's a famine in Israel, and so this guy named Elimelech takes his family and says, we got to go find some food somewhere, so they go to the country of Moab, and then well in Moab, his two sons marry Moabite women. One is named Ruth, one is named Orpah. Well, they're there for about 10 years, and in the course of that 10 years, first off, Elimelech dies. Then neither Ruth nor Orpah seem to be able to have kids. And then both the sons die. So Naomi, Elimelech's wife, left with nothing, decides to head back to Israel because after 10 years she's heard that the famine has passed and there's bread, there's grain in Israel again. And she tells the girls, go home, go to your families, I'm going back to Israel. You go home. And Orpah goes home. She obeys. And Ruth says, no, I'm going with you. And so Ruth travels with Naomi to Israel, to a place where she's never been before. And Ruth is a Moabite. She's going to be viewed with suspicion, even with hatred in Israel. Things look pretty bleak. They look pretty helpless for Ruth and Naomi because they are horribly vulnerable. And the end of chapter 1, if you remember, it ends with Naomi saying, the Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me. So a little bit of tension there. And then we come into chapter 2. I'm going to read chapter 2 for you. Now Naomi had a relative on her husband's side, a man of great standing from the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, let me go to the fields and glean behind anyone in whose eyes I find favor. Naomi said to her, go ahead, my daughter. So she went out, she entered a field, and she began to glean behind the harvesters. Now, as luck would have it, she was working in the field belonging to Boaz, who was from the clan of Elimelech. Just then, Boaz arrived from Bethlehem and greeted his harvesters, "The Lord be with you." "The Lord bless you," they answered. Boaz asked the overseer of his workers, "Who, that young woman over there, who does she belong to?" The overseer replied, "She is a Moabite who came back from Moab with Naomi. She said, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the harvesters.' She came into the field and has remained here from morning till now, except for a short rest in the shelter." So Boaz said to Ruth, "My daughter, listen to me. Don't go and glean in the field, or don't go and glean in another field, and don't go away from here. Stay here, cling to the young women who work for me. Watch the field where the men are harvesting and follow along after the women. I have told the men not to lay a hand on you, and whenever you are thirsty, go get a drink from the water jars that the men have filled." Now at this, she bowed down with her face to the ground. She asked him, "Why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner?" Boaz replied, "I have been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you left your father and your mother and your homeland and came to live with the people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. May I continue to find favor in your eyes, my Lord," she said. "You have put me at ease by speaking kindly to your servant, though I'm not even a part of your household like your servants are." Now later in the day at mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come over here. Have some bread, dip it in the wine vinegar." When she sat down with the harvesters, he offered her an abundance of roasted grain. She ate all she wanted and had some left over. As she got up, Boaz gave orders to his men, "Let her glean among the sheaves and don't reprimand her. Even pull out some stalks for her from the bundles and leave them for her to glean, and don't rebuke or embarrass her." So Ruth gleaned in the field until evening. Then she threshed the barley she had gleaned, and it amounted to about an ephah. She carried it back to town, and her mother-in-law saw how much she had gleaned. Ruth also brought out and gave her what she had left over after she had eaten enough. Her mother-in-law asked her, "Where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." Then Ruth told her mother-in-law about the one at whose place she had been working. "The name of the man I work with today is Boaz," she said. "The Lord bless him," Naomi said to her daughter-in-law. "He has not stopped showing his faithful, loving kindness to the living and the dead." She added, "This man is our close relative. He is one of our guardian redeemers." Then Ruth the Moabite said, "He even said to me, 'Stay with my workers until they finish harvesting all my grain.'" Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It will be good for you, my daughter, to go with the women who work for him, because in someone else's field you might be harmed." So Ruth clung to the women of Boaz to glean until the barley and wheat harvests were finished, and she lived with her mother-in-law. Okay, so things are looking up, but Ruth and Naomi aren't totally out of the woods yet. But this is a good turn of events. And there's two main things in this story that I want us to look at as we go back and kind of see what's happening here. The first is Ruth's vulnerability, and the second is Boaz's response. Now, a major theme throughout chapter 2 is Ruth's extreme vulnerability, her status as a marginalized person. She is living on the margin of society, socially and economically. Even legally, she's right on the edge of even being considered to exist at all. Now, there is heavy emphasis in this chapter that Ruth is a foreigner. It comes through from the narrator, from the characters talking in the story. It repeatedly, she is referred to as Ruth the Moabite. My favorite is that part in verse 6, right, when the overseer of the field talks about her, and he says, "She is a Moabite who came from Moab." Wow, real subtle. She's a foreigner, not from here. Different. Gotcha. Laying it on thick there. But there's a reason for that. It's a big deal. It's a big deal that she's a foreigner, but it's an even bigger deal that she's a Moabite foreigner. Because Amy talked about this, Moab and Israel, they did not get along. These two countries were historical enemies. And at this point in time, I mean, Israel already had what could be considered a strong xenophobic streak. But Moab, oh man, that was especially bad. It was in the law that Moabites were prohibited from entering the Israelite assembly. There were strong rules against marrying Moabite women. Who's Ruth? A Moabite woman who had married an Israelite man. And now is just kind of strolling in, uninvited and unwanted, into the Israelite homeland. Now, of course, even if Ruth wasn't a Moabite, she would still face some pretty significant challenges. All throughout the Old Testament, God repeatedly commands Israel to take special care of three classes of people: widows, orphans, foreigners. It comes up again and again and again. Here's one example from early on in Scripture, Deuteronomy 10, 18 through 19, when God says, actually Moses speaking of God, he defends the cause of the fatherless and the widow and loves the foreigner residing among you, giving them food and clothing. And you are to love those who are foreigners, for you yourselves were foreigners in Egypt. Now, there's passages like that that happen again and again and again throughout the Old Testament, in the law, in the prophets, in the Psalms. It is a big theme. And the reason why widows and orphans and foreigners are singled out is because they were the most vulnerable people. They were the most easily marginalized people in the society. Women and orphans were vulnerable at this time because all power rested with adult men. If you were a child or a woman, you could not own property. And people didn't have cash back there, so it's not like, well, you couldn't have property, but you could have money. Property was money. So you couldn't own anything other than what you were wearing. Your testimony was not considered valid. You had no part in legal proceedings. Any and all social rights and privileges you had flowed through the man of the house, be that the oldest adult son or the father if he was still living. So if you were a widow and you didn't have an adult son who could take care of you, if you were an orphan, you were left totally vulnerable economically, legally, and socially. You might have lost your house, all of your possessions, and most of your relationships. Now, foreigners were also particularly vulnerable. The Hebrew word used here is ger, and a lot of translations say foreigner. It's the best nuance of it really is migrant, because it's the idea of not someone who has come and like fully immigrated and assimilated and put down roots, but of someone who's a little bit more transitory, a migrant. And migrants are particularly vulnerable people. This is true in the Old Testament, and this is still true today. Right? Migrants typically lack social and economic resources. They face a higher risk of social isolation, of economic exclusion, of exploitation. I was reading a study from the U.S. Department of State that shows that being a migrant, especially a woman or a child migrant, puts you at exceptionally high risk for increased rates of violence, rape, and human trafficking. That's true today. It was true in Old Testament times. So multiple times in the text, it refers to being harmed while out in the fields. There's a threat to Ruth here. Widows, orphans, migrants. Now Ruth, she hits all three. Her husband died. She has no father because Elimelech died. And she's an orphan because she has no one in the clan. There's no clan that she belongs to. And Boaz asks, who does she belong to? What he's asking is, what clan is she a part of? What man has authority? And there isn't any. And she's a foreigner. She's from Moab. But Ruth does have at least one super basic protection under Jewish law. Because in Israel, there is a practice called gleaning. There's a word you heard several times and may not have known what it means. It comes out of Hebrew law. Leviticus 19:10 is just one place, one example of this command. It says, when you reap the harvest of your land, do not reap the edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. Do not go over your field a second time or pick up the grapes that have fallen. Leave them for the poor and the migrants. I am the Lord your God. So when you harvested your field, you were not allowed to take all of it. You had to leave the perimeter, and anything that, like, if you missed, because we're not talking big combines, right? We're talking going through by hand. So if you missed a patch, you had to leave it. If some of it fell down while you were carrying it, you had to leave it. If it fell to the ground before you got there to harvest it, you had to leave it. All of that was left for the people who were the poor and the migrants to be able to glean. It was essentially the food stamp program of ancient Israel. But just like our modern SNAP benefits, it only goes so far. It only does so much. At best, people could stave off immediate starvation. Right? So when Ruth brings that grain home to Naomi, and Naomi says, I can't believe how much it was. It was, however, what, an ephah or something like that. It's like roughly, I don't know, 20 quarts. For two people, that gets you a week of food. A week is all they had, even after all this generosity and gleaning. So it's something, but it's not that much. And on top of that, it was dangerous to go gleaning. If you go out into a field, and if you are a widow or an orphan or a migrant, you might be harassed. You might be abused or assaulted. And you don't really have any recourse. You might be denied the right to glean by a landowner who's not observing the law, and there's nothing you can do about it because, remember, you have no place in the assembly and your testimony isn't valid in court. So what are you going to do? You're completely vulnerable. So Ruth, the widow orphan foreigner from Moab, takes a risk, and she goes and gleans in a field. And it's here that we meet Boaz for the first time. Now, right off the bat, we learn three important things about Boaz. He's related to Elimelech, so he has some kind of family relation to Naomi, though we're unclear just what it is. He's a wealthy landowner, and most importantly, he is a man of great standing. The Hebrew used here, it's a phrase, Ish Gabor Hayel. It's used for mighty warriors, but it has a twist. Because it's not a mighty military warrior, his might is righteousness. His might is justice. It's the idea of here is a man with a reputation for upholding justice, who lives in accordance with God's commands. That is what makes him mighty and strong. And so he is a man who is well respected by the community. He was probably the head of a clan, what we would call a chieftain. And by looking at Boaz and looking at how he interacts with Ruth in the midst of her vulnerability, we can see what it means to be mighty in righteousness, what it means to be a man of justice, because Boaz goes above and beyond the basic requirements of the law. He actively blesses and cares for Ruth, the widow orphan migrant. Now, under the law, all that Boaz was required to do was to passively allow Ruth to glean and not interfere with her. That's all he was required to do. But this man of power and of privilege, when he encounters a vulnerable migrant woman, he says, I'm not going to settle for that. He actively goes well beyond the law to protect her and to provide for her in a truly holistic manner. Check out everything that he does for her here. First off, he not only allows her to glean, he takes several steps of making sure that she gets extra food. He lets her harvest in the best places. He says, yeah, follow along with my women. Not the other women who would be gleaning, with the women of my household, with the women working for me, the women who are harvesting. You get first pass at this crop. That's not even gleaning. That's just straight up harvesting that he lets her do. So he gives her that favored position of doing that. He feeds her lunch. Makes sure she has enough to eat. There is no expectation to feed someone lunch. In this culture at this time, for just a poor migrant, some random Moabite, again, like, let them glean, but they stay over there, we stay over here. He feeds her. You only do that for your own household, not for other people. And he doesn't just feed her like, you know, get her a sandwich. No. This is like when you go to grandma's. Because in verse 14, it says he offered her some roasted grain, but the connotation in Hebrew is that, like, he's forcing excessive amounts of food upon her, right? Like, no, eat some more, or look at you, you're wasting away, you've got to take some more. Right, you've got to eat, and then you should probably take seconds, and here's a snack before you head on the road, and I packed you some leftovers too. Like, it's that kind of experience that Ruth is having here. And he provides for her physical safety. He says, I have commanded the men not to lay a hand on you. And remember, who's giving this command? The chieftain, the guy who owns everything, the guy who's the head of the clan. He basically says, she's with me. She has my authority. Don't even think about touching her. He welcomes her into the community. He gives her social standing, because not only has he said, she's with me, she can glean with the woman, she can come eat with us. When she comes and eats with him, he says, here, dip your bread in my cup. That is a significant sign that this woman is to be honored. She's to be welcomed in. She is to be accepted. He gives her a social location, a place to have meaning, a place to belong. He doesn't force her to follow at a distance. He also protects her dignity. When he says to his workers, he commands them, don't shame her. Don't embarrass her when she gleans where she's not supposed to. You see, Boaz seems to understand that, look, she's a foreigner. She doesn't understand our law. She doesn't understand our customs. If you've ever crossed cultures, you know you make a fool of yourself. She is going to make mistakes. She is going to do something that would be a big faux pas. And Boaz says, when she does, treat her kindly. Treat her with love. Respond with grace and kindness instead of suspicion and shame. Boaz then even goes on and he publicly honors her because he says in front of everyone, I have heard what you have done for Naomi. I have heard of your great love, your faithfulness. He says this in front of everyone so that everybody knows who this woman is, what kind of woman she is. She is a woman of honor. And on top of all that, after meeting her physical needs, her social needs, he prays for her and he blesses her in the name of the Lord. And he says, you're not just finding shelter under my wings, you're finding shelter under the Lord's wings here in Israel. That is incredible what he does for her. Now, I began by telling you a story, right, of me in India going into a slum and discovering just how vulnerable I was in that situation, which is still probably nothing compared to Ruth here. But in that place of vulnerability, I was met with hospitality. I was met with love and with care. I stayed there for about 5 weeks and was welcomed in, and I was probably safer there than any other part of the city. Not because of anything I was bringing to the table, but because one of the local leaders knew I was coming. We had a mutual connection, and he made a public show of welcoming me, kind of toured me around, introduced me to all the right people, showed he's with me, and we're going to take care of him. And suddenly, here I am in the middle of a slum with poor people who are feeding me more than I can eat, bringing me tea, giving me honor, protecting me, caring for me in the midst of my vulnerability. I had a Boaz. I had a Boaz who took care of me in a vulnerable spot. It set the tone then for the whole community. This is what Boaz does for Ruth. He takes care of her personally, but also systemically. And he sets the tone for everyone who's going to interact with her. This is how we treat her. So when encountered by Ruth's extreme vulnerability, Boaz responds by embodying the love and the justice of God. Like I said, he actively goes above and beyond the basic requirements of the law. He serves as an example to Ruth and to everyone of who God is, how God acts, and how God's people are called to act toward the vulnerable and the marginalized. So my question for us today is, how can we follow Boaz's example of righteousness? How can we practically care for people who are on the margins of society? Well, broadly speaking, we can respond in personal ways and we can respond in systemic ways, and we should do both. On the personal side, we can do things as simple as taking time to get to know someone, getting to know someone who is on the margins, someone who is excluded from most of our daily communal life for whatever reason. We can learn their story, and we can start to honor them for who they are. We can share a meal. We can extend trust and compassion to a person whom other people view with fear and suspicion. We can share resources with people or families in need. We can give a ride to someone who lacks transportation. You could volunteer at an adult literacy program or with refugee resettlement, things like that. Those are all acts of God's love. We engage in the individual level, but we also need to be people who go beyond the personal to address systemic injustice. Because justice, when we talk about justice and doing justice, justice is what love looks like in public. It's not just that personal sharing something. It's a public way of doing it. So we advocate for in our city, in our state, in our nation, to our leaders, for better care for children, for poor people, for migrants. We support organizations that do international work, but also do work right here in town. Right in our city, Hagar International is working to combat sex trafficking here and all over the world. That's a systemic response. We engage with that. We can challenge some of the economic systems that enable injustice by changing how we live. I would challenge you to read the book Everyday Justice. Everyday Justice is an easy book. It's a simple book. You can read it by yourself. You can read it as a small group, as your engaged group. It helps you see how what you do and how you live is tied into global systems of injustice and oppression and ways to respond. Because sometimes that feels so overwhelming, right? Global injustice, go fix it. I don't know what to do. And this is a book, Everyday Justice. It gives you very simple steps. Here's some practical ways you can start engaging in this and applying what you learn. As Christians, we are called to be people of righteousness, people of justice. Like Boaz, we're supposed to welcome the stranger. We're supposed to welcome the marginalized. And we do this together. We do this united as a church. We don't do this from our own strength. We do this from the Spirit of Christ, a unified body with Christ as the head. And so today, we're going to engage in communion. We're going to take communion with one another. And as we do, I invite you to consider, remember, meditate, think about the words that Jesus said at the beginning of his ministry in the Gospel of Luke. First sermon he gave, he stood up and said, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the imprisoned and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." So the team is going to come up here and they're going to play. We invite all of you, if you are a follower of Jesus, to join us in communion. And if you're a regular here, we're going to do a little bit differently than we normally do. So we'll go down the middle aisle. The elements are in the back. You can take the bread, take the cup, then bring it back to your seat, down the middle, down the sides, back to your seat, and wait to take it. Because we are all going to take it together as a show of unity, that we are united in Christ's body. So down the middle, take the elements up the side.